Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here as we broadcast from Fall Creek, Wisconsin. There we are. We are at the Beaver Creek Reserve, and it's just a wonderful facility and great to be here. And we've got a guest for you who's almost a resident, and at least he lives pretty darn close to the reserve, I think. Michael Perry with us on the show now for the next hour. You know Michael, he's a speaker, he's an author. He's a musician. He does lots of things. His most recent book I really liked. I'm going to talk with him about it at some point. It's titled 40 Acres Deep. And I want to talk with him about that and maybe his multimedia project. He's got his voicemail, which I'm on his list for that. And we'll talk about that, and maybe many here are very familiar with his work. And if you want to join in, are you a fan of his work? Why does it resonate with you? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org, or somebody in our audience can just raise their hand and Jill Nadeau will run with a microphone. Michael Perry, good to have you with us today. Thank you.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me so close to home.
Yeah, how close is close?
Well, I was in Minneapolis this morning, so it really wasn't that close. But we have a little farm. Well, it's a farm. It's been fallow for years, but about 15 minutes from here. Yeah. So my wife grew up in Fall Creek, so.
So you've spent some time here.
Yeah, my daughters went to school here, and as a matter of fact, Beaver Creek Reserve has been a big part of our life here because, first of all, when folks come to visit, you know, you always want something to do. Where can we take you? And this is one of the go-to places, especially if they have young kids. It's a great place to bring company. And then also, in the previous hour, they mentioned that it was a camp at one time. And I know several years ago, we had a big old honking family reunion. And we rented a bunch of those buildings over there and the kitchen and everything and had some wonderful family time here at the reserve. And then the last thing I'd say is that my daughters have both attended Wildland Schools, which is right across the road. And Beaver Creek partners with them on a lot of nature and science projects.
So, very, very close connection. What is it about this part of the Wisconsin? I mean, northern Wisconsin. Kind of northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, kind of. I was talking to my brother this morning. He was logging up north of Highway 8, so I don't want to get too carried away about how northern we are. Now, when I'm out on book tour, yes, I'm definitely from northern Wisconsin.
Here people know better.
That's right. It just depends on who's listening. But, you know, honestly, it's like every other. So part of me knows I'm supposed to say this is just a super beautiful, wonderful area of the country, and it is. The deep green. You know, I was talking to someone just the other day about whenever you mention you're from Wisconsin, you get comments about the frozen tundra. And of course, we have our winters, but people miss the fact that, man, summer here is just steamy and jungly and thriving and thick and beautiful and fertile and fecund, if I may. And but then also, like, just even early here in August, we're getting that first little taste of where there's a couple of those mornings where you go, oh, here it comes. Yeah. And so I think the texture of this area is just lovely. But then ultimately, too, it comes down to the people. And the people, it just depends on who you choose to hang out with.
Well, here you were hanging out in Minnesota, not Minneapolis. I mean, you get around. I mean, what's going on what's happening in your life this time?
You know, I'm in one of those stages where not a lot is coming out publicly, but just working on a lot of things behind the scenes, a couple of different books.
I have a very, very overdue sequel. I wrote a book called The Scavengers, and people are always asking when the sequel is coming out, and for about 10 years, I've been saying in 2 years. but I did receive word from one of my editors that they feel like maybe I really ought to get her done. So I'm working on that, and then I'm working on an odd little book that I don't know if it'll come out or not, but it's someone asked me to give a little talk about, you know, I've been a self-employed guy since 1992. I quit my last real job. And so someone asked me to write about art and trying to, you know, create beauty and be thoughtful and I hope at times artistic, but also pay for the kids' braces and pay for health insurance. And so I'm working on a very short little book about that, kind of the intersection of art and commerce, but based on unlikely mentors, the people I ran into who prepared me for this life long before I ever knew I was going to be doing this life.
Yeah.
And for instance, like what I learned from my nursing studies that actually prepared me to interview people and to interact with people. I'm very shy. I would prefer to never come out of my little room, but I've learned how to perform and I've learned how to do interviews like this. And then a lot of my writing required me to sit down with strangers and ask them questions. Well, I just revert back to the UW School of Nursing where they taught me to go into a tiny room with a complete stranger, have them take their clothes off and ask about their bowel habits. So those folks were preparing me to be a writer. And also, I just want to say, I had no idea. This is a shout out that will be meaningful only to two people in this room. But when I got out of my car, the guy who parked right beside me was my big brother in nursing school. So shout out to Joe RN from Nakusa, Wisconsin. We both look exactly the same as we did in 1984.
You have another
book? Oh, so yeah, working on books, and then I'm touring all the time. I mean, I don't really ever stop touring, and I like to say tour because it sounds fancy, and people think of giant, shiny buses dieseling through the night, but really it's just me in the 2002 Toyota van with the seats tore out and boxes of books and tubs of T-shirts, and it just never stops. I just do, you know, I do corporate speaking gigs. I speak at libraries. I'm doing a thing here in La Crosse in a couple of weeks about farmer mental health. I do humorous, you know, one-man shows. And just a couple of days ago, played a show with my band, The Long Bed. So just always working on new stuff.
You gotta be doing a lot of, you got your fingers in a lot of pies.
Got to, yeah. It's, cause, you know, I'm a, none of it, the one thing I will say is that none of it happens if I don't sit down alone and do the writing. Whether it's a song, whether it's a speech, whether it's a book, at some point I have to sit down and write. And that's my first love, and I can't believe I'm allowed to do it. But I learned from growing up on the farm, my dad, you know, I always say he was a dairy farmer, but we logged in the winter. So I grew up milking cows, but also slinging slabs and skidding logs. And then he also had sheep, and he said that the old timers taught him that you milk the cows for the milk check. That's what you hope would be your regular income. You log in the winter because everything else is froze up, and then you raise the sheep because on a good year between the lambs and the wool, you could maybe cover the property taxes. And that's just kind of how I realized I was never going to be a million seller, super rich, can't sit at home and live off my royalties guy. I just got to keep hustling, but that's kind of in me, and I like the work, and I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, I know you are. And you and I have been talking together for a long time. I mean, I think I first interviewed you when Population 485 came out, which has got to be 24 years ago, maybe?
22 years ago. It came 22? Out in October of 2002. Yeah, and that book, I mean, that book still continues to just have a life of what a privilege and stroke of luck to be allowed to write that book about that place at that time.
Oh man, that is a great book. And I want to talk about, we'll get to it, I want to talk about the play that you wrote based on the book. But I want to talk about, I think it's your most, you know, I know it's your most recent book, which is 40 Acres Deep. And I love that book.
Oh,
thanks. The writing. You're such a great writer, and that story is it's just an amazing story. Maybe give a little overview.
Well, first I want to take a risk. You know, I was really raised, my parents tried to teach us two things, charity and humility. And humility is tricky when you're in a business that requires you to promote yourself constantly.
Yeah.
And some have remarked on this, possibly my own father. So I'm always really careful how I talk about what I do because it's, you know, I'm self-employed. That's the bottom line. But 40 Acres Deep, I really hesitated for a long time about bringing that book out. I really bet. Don't think of myself as a capital W writer or a capital A artist. Nobody's waiting breathlessly for my wisdom. But I do want to put my heart and soul into what I do. And whether it's a humorous monologue or a book about art and commerce, I want there to be soul and heart in it, even if it's serving a pretty well-defined purpose. And there are times when I feel like, you know, if I'm telling the story about the beer tent again, that maybe it seems like I'm coasting. And I hope not, because I still love telling the beer tent story that most people in this room have probably heard multiple times. But 40 Acres Deep, ultimately, a couple of things happened. Number one was it just wouldn't go away. It wouldn't leave my head. And so I thought I'm going to do it. Also, there's a guy named Sturgill Simpson, who's a singer-songwriter. And he does things his own way, and he's so stubborn, and I love his work. And he came out with an album that was very unpopular right around the time that I was thinking about whether or not I should do this. And I listened to that album the first time. I didn't care for it. And by the third time, I was in love with it. And there's a song in there that just made me think, I'm going to go ahead and write this book. And if it sells two copies, that's okay. And we sent it to New York City, my agent out there, who's terrific, and she just said, yep, this is some of the best writing you've done in 20 years, but the publishers aren't going to want it. It doesn't really fit their hook. And I said, well, I kind of figured that's what I'd hear. And so we self-published it. We DIY'd it. But the thing that I wanted to say is that then I just, that's, there was no one telling me what to write in that book, and I love being edited. I need instruction. I accept it. But in this case, I just would sit down in the room, and I would just try to get as deep into that character as I could and just write what I was feeling on that character's behalf. And I also wanted to write the way I used to write in the coffee shop in 1992 when it was bad poetry, but I was so moved, and I felt that again when I was, I've never lost that. But I felt it every time I sat down to work on that tiny little book. And so the part that I'm cautious about saying, because I don't want it to come off as bragging, but I call that book my Just So You Know book. So I can tell funny cow stories, but I can write that book as well.
Yeah,
so
it is.
So ultimately it was just thinking about a farmer struggling to hang on to his, not just his farm, but his life. And then the farmer is also representative of so many of us who feel things changing and the good guys don't always win and feeling powerlessness. And what do you do about that? And yet, how do you still try to see and feel beauty in the world? And so I just went with that character. And I just, on the way here today, I talked to my brother farms up north. And you know, it's tough for him right now. And so I can't fix that by writing that book, but I hope that I can convey to some other people what that feels like.
Yeah, it's tough for a lot of farmers out there. And I know you, I think you told me once that you even showed the book, the writing, to farmers just to see how they might respond.
Yeah, because the other thing I don't want to do is be the guy who's just dipping his toe into something really heavy and saying, I don't have it all figured out. And so I did send it to a couple of farmers, and also because it's an unrelentingly dark book. It's about suicide, and there's an infant death in there. And so I sent it to some people, and the farmers all just said, yeah, it's a hard story, but you should tell it. And then I sent it to some mental health folks as well and got the same message back. So
how's it been received? I mean, it's been out now a year and a half or so.
Well, I'm happy to say from a strictly self-employed perspective, it's in its third printing. We've sold thousands of copies of that book that the New York folks didn't want. So, yeah. And by the way, that's not a finger in the. I still work with. I have a contract right now with HarperCollins, and they've been so good to me. There's just some books that it's better for them to be you know what? Home birth. Sometimes that's the way to go. I had a daughter that way, and I've had a few books that way, and it's worked out just fine.
Michael Perry, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us today for WPR News as we visit now with Michael Perry, New York Times bestselling author, humorist, musician, songwriter, playwright. He's done a lot of things in his life. It's great to have him with us today. Questions for him or comments? I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Pat in Duluth, Minnesota has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I wanted to thank you for all the beautiful work you bring into the world and wanted to ask if you would just talk briefly about your writing routine and or advice for people who are writing and think it's taking them forever.
Well, when you use the word routine, my eyebrows went up. Because I'm not one of those folks that has a real set routine. For years, and I mean decades, I definitely was the guy who said, you must write every day. And I did. No matter what, even if it's a horrible draft, whatever it is, you have to write every day. I've changed that. I met a writer I respected one day, and I started off on my whole, you have to write every day. And he said, well, that's just ridiculous. And I love it when people do. I have another friend he's my friend that when I spend a lot of time alone. I have this theory that writers and truckers and farmers, people like that who spend a lot of time alone, we develop what we call capital T theories, and we polish them and we burnish them because there's no one there to contradict us. And then I have a couple of friends where I'll trot out my very precious theory and they'll listen patiently and then they'll go, well, that's just not how it is at all. And those people are very valuable. And this writer did that for me. He said, no, there's some days when you're just not going to get anything done. You might as well go and work on something else. And I've come to believe that that is right. I do, however, you have to put the miles in. There's just, you know, I work with musicians. I know three or four chords and two strum patterns. That's different than a musician who's worked chords every day or who has worked scales and chords and can transpose on the fly and things like that. And so for me, I did have to write every day. As far as my routine now, it's honestly been driven by the same thing for the last 25 years, and that is I'm freelance. So I'm writing with the hope that at the end of the writing, whether I'm writing a script, like lately I've done a couple of script projects, I do some voiceover work, I do a weekly podcast with a little essay in it, books, whatever, it all, I have to be able to write. But because I'm doing so many different things and because it's how we support our family, I operate based on my nursing and EMT background knowledge of triage, which is to say what absolutely has to be done now to keep the patient alive. And so when I get up in the morning, that's generally it. It's like, what's due next? Just a lot of writing all the time. And then I do allow myself plenty of time when it's available to just write without constraint. And the 40 Acres Deep book was an example of that, where it's like, I think as a writer, I need to work on this project.
Well, it's that particular book was just so meaningful to me. I grew up on a farm, and we didn't have things go the way. It's the old story about, you know, what if you got $1 million? Well, I'll just keep farming until it's gone.
Yep. I did an event the other day, so this... I was asked to speak at an event recently, and it was one of those where you weren't sure quite what you were getting into, and it was in a remote area, and they told me there'd be a bunch of farmers there, but I wasn't sure, and it turned out to be just one of the most lovely evenings. But I stepped to the microphone, and I looked out at the crowd, and I have to kind of decide on the fly my material, and what am I going to do tonight? And I thought, well, they said there's a lot of farmers here, so I'm going to test to see if that's true. And I told a joke where I said, I said something about, does anybody here know why farmers don't wear tennis shoes? And the punchline is, because it's the only piece of clothing the seed company isn't giving away for free.
And it got a huge laugh, and I went, okay, all right. We're going to definitely tell the dead cow story. We're going to, you know, like, the manure spreader story. So what were we talking about before? I've made a living off of going off on tangents, so here we are.
You know, I don't remember myself. That's what's kind of fun about talking with you, Mike. We go, you can get off on a little tangent, and you take me there, and then I forgot where I was headed in the first place.
Well, eventually we'll find our way back. Somewhere somebody's yelling at their radio right now. We're talking about raccoons.
Noreen in Mozambique. Let's do it that way. Let's go to somebody else with a question. Noreen, hello. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to let Michael Perry know that he did a library opening in Kobe, Wisconsin, a number of years ago. Begrudgingly, I talked my boyfriend into going along. And I said, well, sit at the end of the row, way in the back. He's a dairy farmer. If you fall asleep, you fall asleep. I'll just try and keep you from snoring. Well, lo and behold, he paid attention. He sat up straight. He enjoyed it. At the end of the show, and I will tell you, my boyfriend has never in his life read a book. He grew up on a dairy farm. His mother died when he was very young. Nobody really cared, you know, about the education stuff. So he's never read a book. At the end, you read the story when your niece had passed away, and the plane flew over, and he cried. And he was just so engrossed by that story. And from then on, like if we're going on a long trip, I'll bring one of your books and I'll read to him. And he really enjoys that. So,
well, thank you. That, you know, that means so much to me because I live in the in-betweens all the time. I grew up on a dairy farm, grew up with roughnecks. I grew up logging and farming, but I loved books, and my mom taught me how to read, and she filled the house with books. And people in the arts world, poets and dancers and beautiful people, have added this whole other dimension to my life that I never even anticipated. And yet I'm still perfectly happy to go home and just shoot the breeze with loggers. And so any time that we can cross that little gap, I'm so grateful for that story. And you also mentioned it was my nephew that I had written about. And it's tricky when you write nonfiction memoir because sometimes I'm writing other people's stories, and I don't know if that's selfish, and I don't know if I have a right sometimes. And in that case, of course, I got permission, but I remember talking to my brother one time. I'd written about a terrible loss he'd experienced, and I got his permission to write about it. And I told him one time, I said, you know, it isn't that I got to tell your story, it's the number of people who've come to me and said that your story helped them. And to be able to tell him that was very meaningful. So thank you for sharing that. And then now that I've gotten all heavy, like, yeah, I also like, I love telling stories about guys getting kicked by dead cows and things like that. You gotta have both, you know.
You gotta have both. That's such a great story, Noreen. Thank you so much for calling. Rachel in Neillsville, I believe, has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. Yes. Good afternoon. I just wanted to say that I bought the book 40 Acres Deep last year, and it was just, I very much appreciated it. I shared it with a brother of mine. Kept pestering him to give it back to me, and he finally did. I had someone that I lost to suicide in early 2023, but as a native Wisconsinite, it was perfect for me, and I just really appreciate your guest and the show, Larry.
Thank you very much for calling, Rachel.
Yeah, thanks, and thanks for being brave enough to call in and say that. I think there is, again, this balance between not indulging in darkness, but also exploring darkness and just talking about these things. And I can tell you, man, it's all over. So yeah. Thank you for calling and saying that.
I do have to say, in that book, there were some smiles.
I will say, so I should let you talk.
No, I mean,
it's your show.
I just wanted you to come. I mean, well, there are some funny instances in that book too. I mean, it's not all doom and gloom.
If I may, actually, now that you mention it, so I mentioned earlier that I avoid the idea of designating myself as anything that I'm not, you know, men, capital W writer or capital A artist. And so therefore, I rarely, when I sit down to write, I sit down to write what's in my heart or what the editor has requested. And very rarely do I ever sit down and go, I have a cause. You know, it's like the cause will integrate itself if you're just writing from the heart. But rarely do I sit down with a cause. But in that book, I did have a cause. And that cause was, I had, after much reflection, had come to feel that the American literary scene has completely and utterly ignored the topic of torpedo heaters. And I like torpedo heaters. And I said, by gosh, we're going to address that in this book. And so I'm just going to read one little paragraph, which it is a humorous one. And the other thing about this is this whole paragraph, the punchline it ends with is just, it's for the people I grew up with and their recalcitrance, which I actually love. So he's trying to melt snow off the roof of his pole barn because the pole barn's about to collapse. And so he's using his torpedo heaters. And he said, it was a fundamentally glorious thing, a torpedo heater. Loud and basic and atmospherically transformative. It even sounded hot. A blow dryer scaled up to set the curls on a woolly mammoth. He could never really explain why items of this nature gave him such pleasure. His raising, he supposed. It was why he loved old pickup trucks, a good knife, a bolt-action rifle. Layered into the pleasure of their simplicity was the way in which they counterbalanced his philosophical predilections, his susceptibility to fuzzy-headed mawkishness. The fact that he took joy from pushing dirt with a bulldozer ensured he'd never get completely lost in the clouds. There was a decal pasted on the side of the heater. It featured a single declaration bracketed in red exclamation marks. Never leave your torpedo heater unattended. Huh, said Harold, and headed for the house. Them's my people right there. As a dear friend of mine used to say, I'll take that under advisement.
And the ending is hopeful. And
there is a green shoot, literally and figuratively, at the end of the book. Yeah, yes, correct.
You write so much. You've got Michael Perry's voicemail.
Oh, yeah, that's a thing. So for years, I wrote a column for the Wisconsin State Journal called Roughneck Grace. And 9.5 years, it was wonderful. I loved it. And, when that was kind of coming to an end, we started up this voicemail thing I do, which is basically, I can't quite tell. It's a podcast, I guess, because it's me talking into the microphone. I just sit in my
garage. I love it.
I sit in my little room above the garage there, and I just talk. And I usually read a brief little excerpt from one of the books, an essay or a section from one of the longer books, and talk a little bit about the background. And then I share some photos, usually personal photos related to whatever I'm reading about. And then at the end, a thing I started doing, I guess a year or so ago, I have a section called Marginalia.
Yes.
And I love going back through my old books and where I've written notes or underlined things. And then what I do is I just take a picture of a few of those, and then I say, well, here's what I was thinking at the time, and here's what I think now, or here's why I underlined that. And that seems to have really connected with people. I think we all readers do that. And that comes out once a week. And if you go to anything I talk about today, you're best off just to go to sneezingcow.com.
Yeah.
And if you scroll down that homepage, there's a summary right there that just gives you information about all these things, including the podcast, which is called Michael Perry's Voicemail. And yeah, I read into that, and it goes out once a week. And there are some free ones that come out that if you just sign up, you'll get the free ones. And then if you want to get the weekly one, there's a subscription process. But that has,
you know, we kind of did it because we knew that the column was going away, and it's turned out to be just the perfect connection.
And you've done, what, 200, more than 200?
I just recorded. Tomorrow or Friday, I'll be recording episode number 226.
You know, last night I listened, and it's fitting because today is National Radio Day.
Oh, yeah.
In case you didn't know it. I didn't until Jill told me. But I listened to your piece on listening to the radio.
Oh, yeah. AM skip at night, the big 50,000 watt blowers, yeah.
And that was so much fun, just sitting back and listening. You've got a great radio voice, by the way.
Okay, so now you've given me an excuse, and there are folks in the room who are going to know. I just want to very quickly honor one of my great unlikely mentors. Wouldn't be here without him, a guy named Al Ross. Al Ross had classic, what we call velvet pipes.
Yeah.
And I met Al, we used to write ads together, and I'd watch him record them, and I watched how he worked with the mic and what he did with his voice. And the other thing, and I don't know if I can pull it off because I wasn't planning on this, but he also could do the greatest cheesy radio guy. And he'd say, "Welcome, everybody. It's Al Ross. Slide into the air chair. Spin in the platters, the batter, the wax, and stacks of wax, the hits that won't quit. I'm your daddy-o on the radio." Here's to Al.
Oh, man.
That wasn't the guy you heard on WPR.
Well, I really enjoyed that piece on listening to the radio. I mean, you used to work, you got your start writing for a truck magazine in some ways.
Yeah, I was scrabbling along as a freelancer, writing anything I could, writing frozen pizza commercials, whatever it took. And I was writing chapters for medical legal textbooks. I was using my nursing degree to get gigs like that and just scraping along. And then one night I was driving across North Dakota listening to AM radio, and I heard a trucker radio station and it's coming out of the south somewhere, and I pitched the idea of writing about trucker radio to a trucking magazine that I saw in a truck stop, and they said yes, and I wrote that piece for them, and it turned into not only a steady writing gig where I went all over the country, I went on tour with Reba McEntire's Truckers, I went all over, just everything connected to trucks. And the editor was this tremendous fellow who's still a friend. He was fluent in Russian. He was a former investigative reporter for the Nashville Tennessean. And he was a terrific editor. And so I will always tell, you know, the magazine world is a shadow of what it was. But I always tell writers, you know, I would have some of my fancier writer friends would, "Oh, a trucking magazine." I said, "You're dang right."
And they pay.
Right. And 25 years later, I'm reselling that essay in a podcast. So recycling, I meant to say.
You had another one recently about chainsawing.
Yes, chainsawing. So I like to say, well, a lot of times at literary events, I'm like the most rugged dude in the room from northern Wisconsin. But in that piece, I talk about how, yeah, I can run a chainsaw, and I know a couple of things from my logging days. But no, when the tree gets to a certain size or a certain location, I call my brothers.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I got lots of callers waiting to talk to you. Georgia in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Georgia.
Hi. My partner Phil and I have just loved the Jesus Cow, and we've seen Mr. Perry at the Stoughton Opera House. And we were wondering if he's ever considered turning that book into like a stage play.
I've never considered turning the Jesus Cow into a stage play, but it is halfway turned into a screenplay. And I was working on it 2 weeks ago. So far, there's zero interest in it, but that hasn't stopped me. And I will say that, so here's something I can reveal in public. I've already today said I don't sit down and write things with a purpose. They generally just occur organically. And like the idea for that book, The Jesus Cow, occurred spontaneously. But I did do something very intentional when I wrote that book. And that was, I thought, you know, this is one of the few Mike Perry books that could actually be turned into just like a regular movie. And so, not to do a spoiler, but there's a gigantic explosion at the end of that book. And the whole point of the explosion was, this is going to look really, really cool in the movie.
You know, we had an email from someone in Madison asking the same question. So, about, what, you know, are you working on a stage play for it?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, I hadn't thought of that.
Oh, gosh. Well, Tom and DePere, let's go to you. Tom, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have one quick question for you. With all the stories you've told, have you ever been standing behind a cow when it sneezed?
Okay, so I have a several level answer to that, as you might expect, unless I get if I get cut off. But so yes, I have been behind a cow when it ejected something other than milk from the back end, more than once. And what I always tell people is it is a jaw-dropping experience. Although that would not be your best move. And then the second thing I would say, yeah, think about it. So, yes, I have absolutely been splattered in the head and face area. But I would also say I was signing books one time, and I had done the Sneezing Cow story, Never Stand Behind a Sneezing Cow, which is where sneezingcow.com comes from. And afterwards, I was signing books, and an old farmer walked up, and he said, "Young man, I have a bone to pick with you." And I said, "Well, get in line." And he said, "You always talk about never stand behind a sneezing cow." He said, "But cows don't sneeze, they cough." And I said, "You know what? As a former farm kid, you are absolutely right. They cough, and then that happens." But I said, "But as a humorist, a sneezing cow is way funnier than a coughing cow."
Michael Perry, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News Night. Michael Perry, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. We're talking with him about his work and his life and questions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Yeah, standing behind a sneezing cow or a coughing cow is, I've had that happen once, but more often when I was milking cows, I would get nailed by the tail.
Which they would first swab through the gutter.
Exactly.
Yes.
There's nothing like that across your face, man.
Well, and as long as we're exhausting the subject, I'm reminded that in the book Population 45, I write about a call that I was on. A farmer was very seriously injured in his barn. It wasn't funny at all. He was unconscious, had a head injury. But he had landed right behind the cows, and he was on the walkway with his head very close to the gutter and the back of the cows. And I was the first one on scene. And when the pager went off, I was riding my bike. And so I was in my little bike shorts. And so I was the first one there. Well, we couldn't move him because of the injury, and the ambulance wasn't there yet. And so I had to stand. And, you know, when cows get excited,
yeah,
they tend to jettison everything.
Yep. Yes, they do.
And so I was having to stand and shield this gentleman with my back. And eventually one of the helpers came with a piece of plywood, and he deflected everything around us. That was a vivid, vivid day.
Not going to forget that one.
And in my biking shorts, which the crew I ran with up there, there wasn't a lot of biking shorts. This was remarked upon.
Oh, boy. Well, speaking of Population 485, you wrote a play based on the book, and I saw it at the Stoughton Opera House, and loved it very much. And Jill saw it too, loved it, and Jill puts on plays, and I think she put that play on for you. She put that play on in Lake Mills, and is doing it again in October.
Wonderful.
Of this year.
Yeah, I remember sitting down, and someone always said, "Oh, you should sell that as a movie. And I'm like, no, I agree. How do we? That was like when people would always say, you should have your book on Oprah. And go, correct. It's not how it works, but yes. And so, you know, the movie thing never really happened. But then I thought at one point, I'm gonna turn it into a stage play. So I did adapt it into a stage play. And as I'm telling you this, I'm remembering the woman who called earlier and asked about my routine. Here's how it went with the play. For about 3 years, I kept trying to write the play, and I just never quite make it over the hump. And so one day I thought, you know what? This is never gonna happen if I don't have a deadline. And so I call my assistant. We put down a deposit and we rented out 3 theaters and booked the play before I had it written.
Oh.
And then I was like,
that's an enticement.
That's inspiration. And then I locked myself into a little room for 3 days straight and finished the rough draft, and then, you know, and then started polishing. But yeah, it's been really cool to see it. I put together a little troupe, and we took it around the state for a couple of years, and it was just wonderful. And the thing I loved about it was you would stand in the lobby before the play, and you'd have what you'd expect, you know, the crowd that comes to see plays. But you then also have folks maybe in satin bar jackets, or they had the Maltese cross insignia or the EMT cap, and they'd be standing there maybe a little uncomfortable and awkward, and then they'd go in and see the play, and then when they came out, they were laughing, they were crying, and they were telling each other their stories. And that was the part that meant a lot to me, that we weren't just putting on a capital A art event. We were trying to tell the story of some folks who don't always get their story told. So.
That must have, I mean, the response from those folks over the years must have just been fantastic.
It's meaningful, and I still speak. I just spoke at an EMT convention, and I'm going to be speaking to some ER docs here shortly. And, you know, I make hardly any calls anymore. I'm still in the local department as a first responder, but between 5 to 10 calls a year because I'm gone so much. So I'm so wary of that whole I'm a hero business. It's silly and overdone. It's a privilege to serve. And when I wrote that book, I went to great lengths. Like, I am not the best firefighter in the world. I'm not the greatest EMT in the world. But I knew that if I could at least tell their story accurately. And so there's two ways that I can be rewarded with that book, and that's if someone loved the writing and the style, because I worked really hard on that. But also if I can just have somebody on a local fire department come up and go, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Water hammer. Water hammer. We know what that is. Yeah. So.
Well, from that, I know you've got an interesting story involving log splitters and motorcycles.
Oh, yes.
A lot of things like that that seem to be not related exactly.
Well, we do heat with wood in our house. We have a backup off-peak heater, but we 90% of our heat comes from wood, and I just feel like there's just no better child-rearing device in the world than firewood. Cause and effect, baby, right there. It's Saturday morning. You like how that feels laying in front of that? Let me show you how that happens. But I'm always running behind, and I wrote one essay one time about there's no more shameful moment for a man than to stand beside his wife and write a check to another man for firewood. But I've done it. But anyways, when we first moved to the farm, I hand split everything, and then after about 2 years, I went, yeah, well, that's just silly. They make wood splitters. They got one over there at the Farm and Fleet. So I do have a wood splitter, and I have a buddy, Mills, who I've written about many times. And Mills and I met in the ditch maybe at 2 a.m. back in the late 80s on our very first EMT call, a horrible accident. And it was in the dark, and we worked together, and then we didn't know it, but that was the beginning of a 30-year friendship. And Mills is just one of those good-hearted dudes, will do anything for you. He's the best sort of friend. So I am always looking to help him out in any way I can, and he needed to borrow my wood splitter one time, and I said, yeah, man, come and get it. And he showed up with his motorcycle. And we have a wonderful picture of my two daughters standing next to him with a wood splitter hooked to a motorcycle. Like,
That's the kind of friend that you want right there. And if you'd said to him, well, this doesn't seem like a good idea, he'd go, yeah, I know.
Oh, man. Casey at Rice Lake, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling, Casey.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Michael. Nice to talk to you today. Yeah, I'm in Rice Lake, north of Bay, so northern Wisconsin. And my brother's up in Spooner, which is even more northern Wisconsin. Big fan. And you came to Rice Lake a few months ago, and I invited him to come see you at the library. He said, coming up, we got to get in an hour early. I said, nah, we don't have to. Well, we got back row seats, and I got the side eye, so you performed in front of the audience. But anyway, his birthday is coming up in a few months, and I'm just wondering how to get him a shirt or something. Your merchandise, I'm guessing. I'm guessing Sneezing Cow. Do you have t-shirts for guys that can walk around and be walking billboards?
Yeah, we on sneezingcow.com, there's a store page. If you buy a book off of there, it's always signed by me. And then also, we do have, we got your t-shirts, we got your can koozies, we got your stickers. But we do, I think for the discriminating man of style north of Highway 8, definitely we have the Never Stand Behind a Sneezing Cow t-shirt, which we find is very, very popular up in that area. But yeah, thanks. I used to live in Rice Lake. I lived in an apartment above the barbershop on Main Street for about 7 months. I worked for an oral maxillofacial surgeon up there, and I used to come home from that job, and I'd go up in that little apartment, and I'd get my Smith Corona manual typewriter, and I would type stories about working on the ranch in Wyoming and my travels, and I had no idea why, but I just knew I wanted to write a bunch of stuff and someday do something with it. So Rice Lake. And then my kin are from Spooner. A whole bunch of the Perrys come from that Spooner area. And Northwood's Book and Fiber up there is a great little indie bookstore in Spooner. So, yeah.
Yeah. You get around to some of those bookstores once in a while, don't you?
Yeah. Independent booksellers hand-sold me into existence back in the 2000s, and they face an uphill battle, and they've been so great to me. So I try to point folks to them whenever possible.
What's next? I mean, what are you working on right now? Let's talk about some of the things that are going on. Of course, you can always go on to your site, sneezingcow.com.
Yeah, Sneezing Cow, and just scroll down that homepage for the overview. And then, I will be this afternoon, when I get back to where I'm going, I will be answering about a week's worth of emails. That's pretty glamorous. And then the next thing I'll be writing is the script for the next podcast that's coming out next week. And then I will be editing that little book about art and commerce that may or may not ever see the light of day, but you don't know until you finish it. So, yeah.
It's always a pleasure, Michael.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was
working on a new song last week, too, so maybe we'll get that done.
We'll get it done. Next time you're on, we'll have you sing it.
I got to get one of them rhyming dictionaries.
Michael Perry, our guest today. He's a great guy. Thanks so much to him, and thanks so much. I tell you what, it takes a whole lot of people to bring this broadcast live from Fall Creek, and I certainly want to thank our friends at Beaver Creek Nature Reserve. And could not have done this without the support of WPR's Eau Claire Regional Manager. Where is she? Molly Gardner. A Senior Regional Manager, Lisa Nalbandian. Our technical directors, Tom Blaine, Tyler Ditter, and Sarah Hopeful with us right here in Fall Creek. And Jeff Robbins back in Madison. Clara Neipert, of course, our producer today. She's sitting in a closet right now. It's about 4x4, and she's doing the work for that. There she is. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. And thanks so much to his great audience with us today. You've been wonderful. And thank you all for listening. Really appreciate it. And I hope you'll stay with us. There's lots more in store on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.